The Seattle TV station Q13 is a Fox affiliate, but it's not owned by Fox Broadcasting or any other right-wing company. That might be about to change, and you're going to hear about that in about 20 minutes on KUOW's The Record. We are on Twitter at KUOW. Welcome to the show. I'm Bill Radke. Here is our top story. State lawmakers only had one day to vote on a state budget last week. The governor signed it less than an hour before the state government was set to shut down. So we're just now figuring out who got what, and some Puget Sounders think this part of the state got a raw deal because property taxes will go up here hundreds of dollars a year to pay for schools statewide. Let's ask our state executive what's fair. Governor Jay Inslee, thanks for being here again.
Good morning.
Why is it fair that Seattle, Bellevue, Lake Washington, Mercer Island pay more for schools in rural districts?
Well, I don't think it is. I think the Republican plan to raise the property taxes, this was their proposal. They were insistent on it. They threatened to shut down the government if they didn't get their way. And I don't think it was the right way to finance schools. I proposed a way that would actually lower property taxes and still comply with the McCleary decision to fairly and fully fund education. And had they followed our position, we would have accomplished the goal of solving the McCleary funding decision, fully fund our schools, protect mental health, improve children's protection, and still not raise property taxes. So no, I don't think it was the optimal way to do this. But the alternative was shutting down government, not solving the McCleary decision, and neither one of those were acceptable to the people of the state of Washington either. So I'm sorry that the Republicans were insistent on that, but they were. We were successful. The Democratic legislators were successful in cutting by more than half the Republican plan to raise property taxes. And they will have further opportunities as well. So there will be a future session here within 6 months, and I would not be askance or opposed to reviewing this to try to come up with a fair system of the burden for, in fact, supporting education. But I do hope that the fact that of how this happened does not obscure the fact that for finally the state's going to fully finance education, which was an achievement that did happen this year.
Well, let's talk about that achievement. The legislature's been under this state Supreme Court order to fully fund education. How confident are you that that is now checked off?
I believe this is fully compliant with the constitutional requirement, and not only that, it actually goes further than the McCleary decision, and this is an important sort of well-kept secret so far. Not only did this budget remove the onerous burden on local communities, but it also, excuse me just a second, I got an interruption here.
Yeah, ringtone.
So not only did it shift the burden from the local communities to the state, but it also had net increases in educational funding. And this is really an important fact. So assuming that local communities continue their funding as they have to date, as allowed by law, this actually puts an additional $5 billion net new dollars into our schools. So not only is this a replacement of local community financing by the state, but it also increases funding for our schools by over $5 billion over 4 years. That means smaller class sizes, better paid teachers, more mentoring, new technological systems available for people, and help for kids who really need it. So this was not just something that was constitutionally required. It actually improved the resources for schools throughout the state of Washington. So I would consider it a McCleary plus. Now, that does not eliminate the future needs for further funding of things we need to do. Look, we've got to reduce the cost of college education. I wanted to have 17,000 need grant scholarships improvement. We came away with a lot less than that because Republicans didn't want to finance it. We did make improvements in early child education, but not as much as I believe that we need.
Well, did this education funding, does it get, for example, does it get kids in overcrowded Seattle schools out of portable classrooms built on parking lots?
It does help in the K-3. So this budget will fulfill the reduction in the class sizes as voted by the initiative in kindergarten through third grade. It will accomplish that if we get a capital budget. Now, this is another problem because, unfortunately, at the moment, the Republicans in the Senate are refusing to negotiate or pass a capital budget. The Republican Party in the House actually voted almost unanimously to pass a capital budget, but the Republicans in the Senate are holding that hostage to get a water law that they want. So we're hoping that the capital budget will also fulfill that to help that we have buildings. We need teachers, but we also need buildings as well. So we hope that logjam will get broken here in the next few days. We're hopeful.
Well, let's talk budget here. You've got a letter on your desk from 23 House Democrats who are not happy with the tax break for manufacturers. They say it came as a complete surprise, that it doesn't have an expiration date, doesn't include performance metrics. They say funding public schools with a property tax hike while cutting taxes on businesses is, quote, unacceptable and dangerous, and they want you to veto it. Are you going to do that?
Well, we're going to make that decision. I will announce that tomorrow.
How about right now?
I appreciate you trying to get ahead of the curve. Uh-huh. We're signing a bill here, and I don't want to step on that story here right now. If you can wait 12 hours on that, I'd appreciate it.
If I have to.
This is not the way business should be conducted. This thing came out of the blue. It really was something in the midnight hour. It had not been considered by the legislature. People have the right to be disappointed by how that happened. It's not the way tax policy or any policy should be made in the state of Washington. So you don't need a letter from legislators to let me know why people should be disappointed in this. I'm not announcing a decision on this because there's at least one other party I got to listen to before I make a final decision on this. But people rightfully are very upset about how this whole budget was put together, and particularly this onerous budget where the Republicans increased property taxes for people in King County and then gave away multi-million dollars to favored businesses. So I would share that concern. It's one I had before I got a letter from legislators about it.
Well, speaking of fairness, as we were earlier, would it be fair if Republicans and Democrats, they're negotiating and horse trading, and I'll give you this and you give me that, and so the Republicans in the negotiations get this business tax cut, and then you can pick it off like a line item veto? Would that be fair to state Republicans?
Yes, it would be, because we have separate branches of government and everyone understands what the rules are, and the governor has a total ability to veto these bills, and everybody understands that's the rules of the game. Now, where there are agreements that the governor enters into, the governor honors it, and I honor it. When we have an agreement, and frankly, we have one such agreement in the budget regarding two different policy issues, we're going to honor that. So I'm not going to veto a bill that, frankly, I don't like, but we did reach a compromise on that, and we will fully honor that. But there is no such agreement in this case, and the governor and I am totally authorized to exercise our veto authority. It's not a line item veto. It's actually separate bills.
It's a separate bill.
These revenues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as you say, you've got the governor's chair. You're a Democrat. The Democrats control the House as well. But still, Democrats didn't. There's a lot they didn't get. They didn't get a capital gains tax, didn't get a carbon tax to put a price on carbon, didn't stop business tax cuts yet. You know, a Seattle Times columnist, governor, said Democrats, they got rolled as usual. Did Democrats get rolled, and did you get rolled?
Well, I think what you see is anybody who's had Civics 101 understands what divided government means. It means compromise. And yes, there were compromises on both sides. That's clear. And some of them were disappointing to all of us, including myself. But I think all of us, and particularly the Democrats, can be feel very good about the fact that we got a McCleary decision. We fully financed education. Frankly, Republicans, as of last summer, insisted we were not going to do that. Now, you got to understand, last summer the Republican Party wrote a letter saying to the Supreme Court telling you can drop dead. We are not going to do this. Well, guess what? They did it. We forced them to do it. We have fully, fairly financed education. It was over the objections of the Republican Party, and we won that big time. So this is a major achievement for the people, and I would argue for the Democratic Party. We won the effort when the Democrat Republicans tried to cut mental health. We not only did not cut mental health, we actually improved financing over $100 million. And that's extremely important for the least amongst us. We've passed a children's new provision that will have a whole new department dedicated to preventative services for children. We passed a family leave provision. Democrats have been working on this for 20 years. I talked to John Burbank about this. We started this effort back in the late 1980s, and now we're one of five only states, and arguably we have the best family leave policy in the United States. We won in the ability to hire more nurses at Western State Hospital. The Republicans objected to that. We won that. We actually financed that. We won new money for mentoring for our new teachers. And we won, importantly, improving teacher compensation so we can keep teachers in the classroom. We won the collective bargaining debate. The Republicans did not want to finance the collective bargaining agreement so we can keep state employees at these hospitals actually employed. So this is what divided government looks like. I wish we did not have divided government. We're going to have the ability to change that fairly rapidly. There's actually a special election this November that could change control of the state Senate.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to the day when all of the Democratic priorities that I've advanced can prevail. But the fact is that we were facing a government shutdown.
Yeah.
Two or three states have experienced a government shutdown. There are 10 states that don't have a budget today, even though they've gone past their deadline. And compromises were made on both sides. And I will just tell you that I think the most important thing to realize is that the things I laid out are the three things that I said the legislatures had to do this year. They had to finance McCleary. We overcame Republican resistance to doing that. Number two, they had to do it in a way that did not gut the social services that take care of the people who need it in our state. They proposed doing that. We defeated them. We stopped them from doing that. We maintained the existing level of services for people who need mental health, who are homeless, children, veterans, seniors in their programs. We stopped doing on a local level what Donald Trump's trying to do at a federal level, and we won that, and that was a big win. And third, we have changed the way we've made the start on some very transformative ways of the way the government provides services. So this new children's division, which is going to be preventative rather than reactive.
Okay.
We're changing the way that we're doing mental health. So the three things that I insisted on, all three things of those things were big wins for the state of Washington. And I think they're things worth writing home about.
Governor, you mentioned the special election coming up. And that's a situation where your party could control both houses plus the governorship if Democrats were to win this. This is the special election for the 45th district, and it's getting some national attention, as so many special elections have. Politico, the national publication Politico, ran a story calling it the next national special election clash. So my first question is, high-profile special elections have not been going well for the Democrats so far. Would you rather not make such a big deal out of this one?
No, it is a big deal because the Republicans in the state here have been trying to do, to some degree, the same thing that Donald Trump has done, and that needs to be stopped. And so this does have both local and national repercussions. I would disagree with you when you say Democrats haven't done well. Actually, Democratic performance has gone up 4 or 5% on the 20 elections that have been held to date.
They've gained ground. Haven't gained seats.
That's correct. In the four elections, and this is, I wish people paid a little more attention to this, Democrats got their hopes up way, way above where they should have been on these four elections. All four of these seats were people that left Congress to go work for Donald Trump. Now, I can assure you those are extremely a different type of people who get hired to work for Donald Trump. The reason they were hired is these are totally safe Republican seats. That's the only reason they were hired. The administrations don't hire congressmen to take jobs in the administration unless they come from entirely safe Republican seats.
Okay, so you're okay with the national media getting...
We are totally ready for these election cycles.
Uh-huh.
I believe people are going to express themselves in droves against the incredible ineffectiveness of this president, and I'm confident we are going to defeat this president. Look, we're a country who defeated fascism, defeated communism, and we're going to defeat narcissism. And that's what we got in the White House right now, and eventually it's going to be defeated.
If you had both houses and the governorship under Democratic control, what would you get done?
Well, I think that there are a number of things that clearly need to get done that have not. Number one, this tax situation, that I think that we can take several opportunities to alleviate the burden of the Republican property tax cut or Republican property tax increase. There are a variety of ways to do that. I have suggested in my budget several ways to do that.
What's your number one tax idea then? Not you, because you don't like the statewide income tax, right?
No, we proposed either a carbon tax that will be a tax on polluting industries, or a capital gains tax, which would be on less than 1% of Washingtonians in the million-dollar class.
Mm-hmm.
There are a variety of ways that we could reduce the property tax burden on people in the upcoming sessions. We have to do things that will actually respond to climate change challenges. Unfortunately, we have The opposition party has not been willing to help fashion a way to respond to the damage our state is suffering at the hands of carbon pollution and ocean acidification.
Okay.
There's much more work to be done on that.
Carbon tax, capital gains tax. Do you haven't supported a statewide income tax, but Seattle looks close to passing one. Do you support one for Seattle?
I'm not supportive of an income tax.
Why is
the state
that?
Of Washington. I've made that clear. Well, I think there's better methods, and I have suggested two of them: a capital gains tax, which is a tax on not wages. It's very important for people to understand that. It is only a tax that falls on what it says, capital gains. You can exclude gains from the sale of your home. You can exclude gains from retirement income. It's a better way. It's a progressive way, and it is supported by the people of the state of Washington. A carbon tax also has the benefit of reducing pollution, and I believe it makes sense at some point to consider a price on carbon to some degree to reduce pollution. We have a president who is one of the only national leaders in the entire world who is denying this science. Our state is the most scientifically literate place in the world. We're the most technologically advanced, and our state's going to lead on carbon policy. We're doing it today by having a limit on carbon pollution by rule. We're doing it today by inventing new technologies at our University of Washington and WSU and Western. We're doing it today by electrifying our transportation fleet. But there's more work to do because there is no leadership coming out of the White House, and I think that's most unfortunate. So Washington is going to do what we always do, which is lead.
Okay.
And I'm confident of that.
Couple more questions for Governor Jay Inslee. The Trump administration has requested states turn over more information about voters, and you said, I would strongly suggest they jump in Lake Washington. Why not help the federal government target voter fraud the way they say they want to?
Well, let's understand, this is just part of, unfortunately, the effort to suppress voting in our country. We've seen it in many states. The courts have stopped the Republicans from suppressing the vote, but this is either part of the suppression effort to try to suppress the vote, or just a continuation of the insecurity of the president, who still is just fixated on the fact that he got less votes than his opponent.
How would he be suppressing the vote in Washington State? What do you think he's up to?
There are a variety of things that they've done in other states. We have resisted their efforts to date to try to make it more difficult for people to vote. Look, if you've been voting for 40 years in the state, I don't think you should have to go dig out your birth certificate from your elementary school to go vote. And that's what they've done in other states to try to suppress the vote and make it more difficult for people to vote. And that's been slapped down by numerous courts, but we don't want to continue that. But mostly this is just Donald Trump's insecurity at play, because he can't stand the fact that he got less votes than his opponent. And I wish he'd spend more time working on how to really improve health care rather than take it away from 750,000 Washingtonians, rather than this sort of paranoia is too strong a word perhaps, but looking for a problem where there's no problem. Look, our Republican Secretary of State, Kim Wyman, has said it is ludicrous, and I'm quoting her, it is ludicrous to say that there's been a problem of some significant voter fraud. There's just no evidence that that exists. And now we're wasting time on this issue. We ought to make it easier for people to vote rather than more difficult.
Okay, time to say goodbye, Governor Inslee. Can we not do the triple special session or maybe even any special sessions next time around? I don't know how LBJ did it. You know, they said he knocked heads and all that. I don't know, what does a tough executive do? Can we avoid the last minute fireworks?
Well, LBJ had a Democratic Senate, a Democratic House, and that's an entirely different universe.
That helps.
And I have done everything humanly possible, including giving the legislators a method and a path to show how to finance McCleary, and I did that very early. I have had umpteen meetings with them. I have put them in the room face-to-face together. So I've done everything humanly possible, but here's the difficulty. Essentially, and we're not the only state that has experienced this. There's two or three states whose government shut down right now. There's 10 that don't have a budget. This is not unique, unfortunately, to our legislature. They just refused to negotiate until 5 days before the government shut down. It was the only deadline that they reacted to. It's very unfortunate. I'm going to ask the University of Washington to do some research to come up with a new drug to give legislators to prevent them from that particular behavior. How's
okay.
that for a response?
Yes, the health industry can be working on this problem, and maybe
there
we can be more calm. next time around. Governor Jay Inslee, thanks for joining us again on KUOW.
Thank you.
We
good
appreciate
luck.
It. KUOW's The Record. Back in just a moment, we're going to talk about what Kim Jong-un is up to. Speaking of tough executives, stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record.
It's a shame that they're behaving this way, but they are behaving in a very, very dangerous manner, and something will have to be done about it.
President Donald Trump speaking this morning in Poland about North Korea's latest missile launch. The North Koreans test-launched a long-range missile this week that some experts say could reach Alaska, and maybe someday they'd like to put a nuclear warhead on it. How did we get here? And why is a secretive, isolated, by all accounts, starving regime so focused on getting the attention of the United States in this way? Let's figure it out with Seattle-based journalist and author Blaine Harden, a producer for the PBS show Frontline. He spent years writing books and articles on North Korea. Welcome, Blaine.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
We invited you here to talk about the backstory, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, but there's so much heated ICBM talk right now. I just want to know, do you lose 1 minute of sleep over headlines about a North Korean missile test?
Yes.
You do.
Yes, it's very concerning. They're making steady progress to the creation of a missile that could hit the United States, and it's concerning.
Now the backstory, and we'll work forward. How did we get here with North Korea?
Well, the United States and South Korea fought a very bloody war with the North, 1950 to 1953.
My father was there.
Right. Yeah. And it's a war that a lot of Americans forget about, but it's a war that the North Koreans think ended last Thursday. They live in isolation, and they're constantly reminded about the suffering of the population during the war. It's important to realize the North Koreans started that war by invading the South, but the United States came in and then punished North Korea severely for the invasion. The bombing of North Korea was continuous. It lasted for almost 3 years. And American Air Force bombers destroyed every city and town in the country. And by U.S. government estimates, killed as many as 20% of the population.
20%.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot of suffering. What does that have to do with where we are today with North Korea?
The current regime is, you know, it's a dictatorship. It's a totalitarian dictatorship, the longest lasting such government in world history. It's lasted more than twice as long as Mao's China or Stalin's Soviet Union, 70 years almost. And what a dictatorship like that needs is an enemy. An enemy is a great reason for having a dictator, because he can fight the enemy, he can protect the people. Getting back to the war, the regime constantly reminds its population of their suffering during the war. Very few people are alive from that era, but they're reminded almost on a daily basis of what the United States did to them. And the bargain that the Kim family has struck with its people, it's a repressive bargain, but the bargain still is, we'll protect you from the American bastards, as they call them, and in exchange, you'll put up with repression endlessly. So confrontation with the United States through nukes, long-range missiles, is really part of a survival strategy for that kind of government.
How much do you think the North Korean people know about their relative deprivation? Because that would be part of the bargain that they would decide to strike or not with their dictator.
They know a lot more than they used to. In the past 20 years, the border with China has become semi-permeable. Lots of electronic gizmos have moved across that border. DVDs, laptops, USB fobs, and small radios. There are some U.S. government estimates that between 40 and 60% of the population listens regularly to foreign radio broadcasts. And so people do not live in information isolation like they used to. However, the state is still incredibly repressive. And while people may have more information in their heads about the outside world, their ability to act on that, to have a civil society where they can go and talk with their friends about it, is severely restricted.
But is there evidence that the people are chafing under that and that they want a different bargain with Kim Jong-un?
Very little evidence of it.
Okay.
But there's evidence that they have more information.
Okay. All right. So given this backdrop then, what does Kim Jong-un want right now?
I think he wants to survive. He saw what happened. He and his father, Kim Jong-il, and his grandfather, they saw what happened in Eastern Europe with the collapse of communism, particularly what happened to Nicolae Ceaușescu, who was lined up against a wall and machine gunned to death, along with his lovely wife. And they also saw what happened to Gaddafi after he gave up his nukes. So the lesson they've learned is endless confrontation and toughness is a way to survive. And the proof is sort of in the pudding. The grandfather died at 84 in his bed. The father died at 69 in his bed or in a hospital bed. And Kim Jong-un is a good student of his family's history.
But he's not just acquiring the ability to launch missiles and maybe put a warhead on them quietly in self-defense. He's also acting so belligerent. How is that part of the plan?
Well, if you can confront the great enemy, the great Satan, the United States, and show strength, it gives you legitimacy as a dictator.
Okay. And what's the ultimate goal in this? So he survives, and that's it. So my people like me because I'm tough and belligerent, and countries won't mess with me if I have a nuclear warhead. What about the possibility? Well, especially Donald Trump, you know, seems like the kind of person who might try to prevent North Korea from getting a nuclear warhead. Is that part of Kim's calculation?
I think their calculation is that nukes are a great insurance policy for the long-term survival of the regime. North Korea, as I said, did attack the South in 1950. They did with the backing of the Soviet Union, with Stalin's approval and arms. At the time of that attack, the North Koreans, the Soviet Union, were convinced that the United States would not respond. In the Soviet archives, there are conversations that have been released which show that Kim assured Stalin the Americans would not respond, and Stalin basically said, I don't think they will either. For Kim Jong-un, looking at the contemporary situation of whether an invasion of South Korea or an unprovoked missile attack on Japan or the United States, he knows there would be a sharp and punishing and destructive response. He's not crazy. His father wasn't crazy. His grandfather wasn't crazy. And again, this regime has survived longer than any such government in world history. So they know what they're doing. They do not offer their people a good life, but that's not the point. The point is to continue to control this relatively small country, 25 million people, and not be tried for war crimes. It's really worth mentioning, too, that North Korea is incredibly cruel to its own people and has been in a sustained way that is also without precedent in world history. They've had concentration camps in the country for more than twice as long as Stalin operated the Gulag. And it continues to function. Satellite photographs now show that those camps are a vibrant part of the survival system. He tries to intimidate people, the leadership does, and those who will not be intimidated are sent to the camps where they're worked to death.
So now what to do? You heard President Trump say something has to be done about North Korea. I'm sure he's listening to us right now, so here's your chance. How should the United States deal with North Korea?
Well, I'm much less comfortable predicting what should be done because I don't know. But it seems to me that diplomacy is a good option because it's cheap, people don't die, and it buys time. At some point, this regime is going to collapse. So diplomacy...
How do you envision it collapsing?
More information is coming into the country. Fewer people are wholly captive to the Kim's version of reality.
Okay.
Another thing that's happening that's really destabilizing to the Kim regime is the marketization of the economy. There was a severe famine in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which ruined their command economy in North Korea. And to survive, the Kim regime had to put up with markets, street markets, to deliver food, clothing, things that the state could no longer do. That market has become a very important part of the North Korean economy. People have made money, people who do not work for the state. In a state like North Korea, if you have money of your own and you're not beholden to the state in the same way, that's a completely different kind of government. Of situation to control. And so that is also destabilizing. So information and money that's not in the complete control of the regime are new developments and destabilizing going forward.
So maybe wait and the North Korean experiment will collapse of its own weight.
And negotiations could do, the United States could offer maybe to cut back on its military practices with South Korea for war. It could offer diplomatic recognition. It could declare an end to the Korean War, which is never really formally end. It could give North Korea some of the things that it's long wanted in hopes that with an agreement that the North Koreans would suspend development of missile launches and of nuclear development, not get rid of it, but suspend new development.
Uh-huh.
That's a possibility.
Okay. Will you come again? I mean, let's just watch this together and follow it along.
I'd be happy to talk about it.
Blaine Harden, journalist, author, spent his career writing about North Korea. His latest book is King of Spies, and it comes out this October. Blaine, thank you for setting the scene for us.
My pleasure.
KUOW's The Record. Back in a moment. This is KUOW Seattle. In February of 2016, Andre Taylor was in Los Angeles when he got a phone call from his stepmom in Seattle. She told him his little brother Shay had been shot by the police. Shay Taylor was standing next to the open door of a car. The two officers said he was reaching for a gun when they fired. Today, Andre Taylor is working with an organization called De-Escalate Washington to change state law to make it easier to bring a police officer to trial. Right now, in order to prosecute an officer in Washington state, you have to prove they acted with malice or in bad faith. Andre Taylor says that law doesn't work.
This law was instituted in 1986. So the Seattle Times came out with an article saying from 2004 to 2015, 214 people were killed by Washington state officers, and not one officer in all that time was ever convicted, held accountable for a crime. Not one. Mathematically, that is impossible. That in all those incidences, an officer didn't do anything wrong. So we have a real problem in our law that probably encourages bad behavior, right? We are not against police. We're just pro-community. But we understand how important it is. When I say we, I'm speaking of our new initiative, which is called, the campaign is called De-Escalate Washington.
How would your state initiative change that language from malice and bad faith to what?
Well, the problem with the law is that good faith intent has no definition to it. It is not defined. Right. So we defined that. We brought three, four attorneys that took a four to five month process of having a definition of what good faith is. Right. So right now there is a subjective idea of good faith. So we said, well, there has to be two things that an officer has to qualify, good faith subjectively and good faith objectively. In other words, right now, when an officer says, I feel threatened, or I fear it for my life, that's all he needs to say. The circumstances of the case don't come into place. that's problematic, right? So we can't look and see. Well, I'll give listeners a perfect illustration real quickly. If an average citizen commits a murder, there is a homicide investigation that takes place. That homicide investigation might start a year or two before the incident because they want to find out what was going on leading up to this homicide. Was somebody being unfaithful? What was going on, right? Well, when a police officer uses deadly force, there is no homicide investigation. The only thing that they want to know is that he followed the law. But the law in our state says the only way we can bring you up on charges is we have to know what was in your mind. We will never be able to know what's in an officer's mind. So we have had officers that have never been held accountable in 214 cases from 2005 to 2014.
So what's the new standard that
you
want? The
new standard is a good faith standard, that your good faith standard has to be objective, right? So now we can bring in the circumstances of a case, which we couldn't before, right? We could see whether your behavior comes into play. Now our law don't bring an individual's behavior into play, right? Perfect illustration. I said to Dan Satterberg, the officers gave my brother commands. If those commands that the officers gave my brother put him in a place, right, that made them feel threatened, my brother should not be responsible for that. They should. But there's a de facto immunity in our law, which is problematic. We want to take that de facto immunity out of the law, not to make it easier to prosecute officers. That's not what it's for. To make it possible. It's not even possible in our state.
Andre, another part of your initiative, 940, involves de-escalation training mm-hmm. and mental health training. Officers already get training. In fact, in Seattle, one of the officers involved in the killing of Charlena Lyles had received the 40-hour crisis intervention training. How is the training that, under your initiative, how do those requirements change?
To your point of the officer saying that he had a crisis training, the tragic thing is he said he didn't use it. His statement was he didn't use his training.
Well, then what good does more training do?
Because 40 hours or 8 hours is not sufficient for an officer that has been on the force for 5-10 years, because a person is always predisposed to go back to a behavior that they're comfortable with, right? So if he's been trained to kill, center mass, to put you down, right?
Center mass meaning shoot, you're pointing at your own chest.
Right. If you've been trained that way, and officers have said they are trained to put you down, to kill you, then if you only had 8 hours of de-escalation, if a situation comes about, you're going to resort back to what you've been trained for 10-15 years, right? So there needs to be a continual training, right? So that officers begin to operate in this new training, but that takes time. 8 hours is not enough time. 40 hours is not enough time.
You also want mandatory first aid training for officers.
The rendering of first aid.
So they've got to, that part becomes part of their job, that they give first aid to somebody who's down, and that's personal for you with your brother.
It is personal. I think that we've seen incidences around this country that people might have had the opportunity to live, but there was no first aid training given fast enough, right? Now, we don't want to give you a perfect illustration. If an officer is in a situation where there's some type of sniper where it might render him kind of, you know, impossible at that time to render first aid, that's understandable, right? But in my brother's case, he was shot, you handcuffed him, you touched him. He was no threat to you. At that moment, you should have rendered first aid. You had multiple officers around to secure the scene, but they didn't. So then that bias comes in, right? Maybe they wanted him killed. Maybe they didn't like him. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just saying, to prevent that, let's make something mandatory that you should render first aid, right, if you've shot somebody, right?
I'm talking with Andre Taylor, who is the big brother of Shea Taylor, who was killed last year in North Seattle by police. I saw you quoted as saying, the system does not respond to people's pain. Mm-hmm. It responds to people's organizing. If pain and hurt is not bridled, it can lead to individuals acting out on that pain. And I got this image of you trying to rein in your own, to bridle your own pain to get through this.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that right? And what is that like for you?
Well, if I have an advantage of looking at things historically, and you see things that have worked and things that have not worked. And as of late, you've seen around the country, people are extremely frustrated, and they should be, and they are in pain, and they should be, because they've lost their loved ones. But what I haven't seen is that the system respond to that in any significant way. And so when I came back to Seattle when my brother was murdered, I decided that we would do things a little differently with my organization, not this time. We would create a safe place where we can have real dialogue and real conversation, right? But I would have to do it first before I could talk about doing it, right? So we talked to Chief of Police Kathleen O'Toole. I sat down with her and I told her, I know I can't bring my brother back, but I believe that if we work together, we could reduce the incidences of violence in our community. And I'm willing to work with you to do that. That's a different narrative. That challenges the system and it sets a precedent for my own community, right? Because I've seen that work before in the past. And there's no sense of trying to create the will. I've seen having a big tent. I don't care who you love. I don't care what you look like, what religion you're from. If you're about social justice, come be a part of this and help us and let's work together. So we went and talked to Latino organizations, Native tribes, and we got white allies. And I said, we have to be a big tent, nothing small, nothing marginalized, right? And we together can make it happen. That has worked before in the past, and that is the only way that we secure change for our future.
Andre Taylor is the brother of the late Shea Taylor, and Andre is now leading a group called De-Escalate Washington. They are kicking off signature gathering today for an initiative to make it easier to prosecute police officers who use deadly force, and it would require more mental health and de-escalation training. So that's an initiative to the people, to the voter. That's one way to change state law. But you know, some Washington lawmakers tried to change this law on police use of deadly force, but the bill didn't make it out of committee. Let's talk now to Republican Representative Dave Hayes, who represents Island and parts of Snohomish County in the state legislature. He does not support this initiative 940. He's also a sergeant with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office, and he says he knows from personal experience why the language of the state law should not change.
There's one in particular situation that I was involved in many years ago. I was a young deputy working up in the Tulalip area, Marysville area, and walked in, and there's a man there that he plowed over the back of a female. And what I didn't understand at the time, I walked into this situation and they were fighting over a knife. And I had no idea what the situation was. And one thing that I'd like to point out to folks is that law enforcement officers are called to and expected to go into situations where they don't know all the facts. They walk into the middle of a situation that the facts are not plainly observable. In this particular situation, there was a man over the back of a woman. They were both in standing position, fighting over this knife. And what I didn't realize at the time was that the man was trying to take the knife away from the female, who had been threatening others and herself with this knife.
What happened to that man and that woman?
In that particular situation, I followed my training and experience. I'd been a law enforcement officer at the time for about 6 or 7 years at the time, so I was no spring chicken. But I drew my weapon and had it at low ready and began giving verbal commands. And this isn't a situation that a law enforcement officer wants to go and put hands on. The woman released the knife and stepped away. The man now had the knife. I gave him verbal commands and he followed them. But it was one of those very tense situations that I walked into and I didn't realize what was going on.
Are you saying you could have made what an outside group in hindsight could have seen as a mistake, because in the moment you might have feared for your life without having all the facts?
Correct. I could have. Maybe a less experienced officer would have made a different decision. Maybe a more experienced officer would have made a different decision even than I made. And sometimes we're put into situations where there's two officers, one shoots and the other one doesn't, or one takes an action and the other one doesn't. And there's always questions around that. There's always questions about why didn't we use less lethal use of force, and why aren't we trained to use less lethal first? And quite frankly, we are, but every single situation is different.
Washington law states that an officer can't be convicted of a crime for using deadly force if she or he acted in good faith and without malice, or what the law calls evil intent. But how could a jury ever know that an officer is acting with malice or evil intent?
Well, that comes down to the facts and circumstances surrounding that existing, the situation that the officer was placed in, and the actions that the officer makes, the statements that he or she makes. So there's a collection of evidence process that any investigation would follow that would determine those facts and circumstances that might lead to whether or not the officer acted with or without malice.
Well, for example, Washington State has a relatively strict law here. There are states where the law says an officer can shoot if they have a reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm. If they are deemed to have a reasonable fear, why couldn't Washington State law use that definition instead of a malice standard?
Well, what's the intent of making the change in the first place? So is the intent to improve public safety, or is the intent to prosecute police officers? That's the question that folks are going to need to answer for themselves. Will this new law change the way law enforcement officers do our job, or will it not? Will changing that charging standard lead to a safer community? Or will changing that charging standard simply put law enforcement officers in jail or hold them more accountable?
Well, that word accountable is the key to what the advocates for this law change are saying, that public safety is important and officer accountability. That's what this is about.
Right, and I certainly understand that. So, but will it necessarily change anything? If you go to those other states and do an analysis across our nation and see which states officers are being charged with crimes and which states they're not, even those states with a what would be perceived as being a lower charging standard, you made that made reference to just the term reasonable. Even in those states, officers still aren't being charged with crimes.
That's true. It just happened in Minnesota with the Philando Castile shooting. That's one of those states that have a lower standard.
Right. So, yeah, and in that particular case, he was charged, probably rightfully charged, and the jury made the decision that they made based on the facts and circumstances presented to them in court. So, and that kind of brings me back to what is the intent of making this change? Is the intent to make more prosecutions, or is the intent to make it a safer community? And I believe that there are better routes to creating a safer community than simply changing that charging standard.
Let me just ask you about a couple of other ingredients in this state initiative proposed. One is that it calls for more mental health and de-escalation and first aid training for officers. What do you think of that requirement of more training?
Well, one thing that I'd like to point out is it seems to me that there's a misconception out there in the public or in these the communities that are making this proposal that we're not getting training in mental health and how to deal with mental health folks. We're not getting training in first aid and de-escalation and all those. We get fantastic training at the Criminal Justice Training Center.
Well, I talked about exactly this with Andre Taylor, who said, yes, police do get training, but we don't understand the way the mind works. If you don't get more and consistent and thorough training, then in a heated situation, you're just going to revert to more instinct and less training, and that we need still more training.
There might be examples of acting on instinct instead of based on training. Is there ever going to be enough training in place to cover every single one of these situations? How much training are we talking about? And as I read that initiative, I felt that it was very subjective. It had very subjective language about how much training is going to be necessary, because it leaves it up to the Criminal Justice Training Center to determine how much training is necessary. Now, the state of Washington has spent substantial resources and already in increasing critical incident training for law enforcement officers. And the critical incident training that I'm talking about, we do talk about de-escalation. We do talk about shoot, no shoot. We do talk about dealing with people with disabilities and mental health. And there's already existing state law that mandates our basic academy trainees to receive training in basic and continuing in service. So can we improve on that? Maybe. But we do already receive substantial training.
Okay, final question, Representative Hayes. I know you're not a fan of doing this through an initiative process to the voters, but what if this were just about because this has come up in the legislature. What if legislators changed Washington State's law to be like most other American states' law and lowering the threshold for prosecuting officers after a shooting? Is there language, legislatively reached language, that you could support on that, or are you a no vote?
Well, there is quite possibly language that I could take a yes vote on. But I would have to see that, and it's going to be, there's already several different definitions out there about the reasonable officer standard. Snohomish County Prosecutor Mark Rowe and another fellow from the city of Seattle, I'm not recalling his name, wrote some that they feel is most appropriate, and that was represented in one of the pieces of legislation that was considered this year. But then there's others that law enforcement have brought forward. So we need to banter those things back around and make sure we're making the best possible decision.
Again, that's Representative Dave Hayes, a Republican from Island County, who's also a sergeant with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office. He opposes Initiative 40. Supporters of that initiative started gathering signatures today. This is KUOW.